borrowed from Brother Billington on, I think it was on Tagarma, and it said Ezekiel 37:14, and it should have said 27:14. So that was pointed out, and thank you to those that caught it, because I didn't catch it. And I'm not sure if it was one I did or one that I borrowed from Brother Billington, but I'm known for typos, just like I'm known for making up new words. So that's okay. There is a small possibility that though I've done my best to end class right on the nose every period, that I might ask for a little bit of, you know, be patient on this one. We're probably going to go a little more than 45 minutes here. I'm going to try to keep it down because I know how hard it is to sometimes sit and listen. Slides. There's been a question about the sharing of the presentation that I have here. And I know sooner or later Larry will ask me for a copy of it too, but what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to go home, and there are about 10 slides here that I purchased from a graphic designer. And on the graphic designer's website, it has this really prominent scripture on it that says, "Thou shalt not steal." So since I paid for them, I'm not going to share them in such a way to honor this graphic designer's request that this is not freeware. I'm going to have to go home and on the PowerPoint put copyrighted over it or something. Because as Christadelphians, we should honor that, right? Somebody did the work and they want to be paid for it. So I'll get that done and I'll make slides available to everyone. But some of them are going to say copyrighted on there. Not because I've copyrighted it, but the designer who did it, and I paid for the use of it, and we're gonna honor that. So the two things: the one slide had a typo. It's Ezekiel 27:14, not 37. So here's where I ended up, and I want to come back to here because I think that once again this is part of the things that we really need to get right. And young people, this is one of the things that I really want you to be able to get right in your mind. All right? Ezekiel's restoration prophecies, 30 through 39, are not meant to be chronological. But a lot of times when we debate what these prophecies mean, the argument that we hear so, well, let's be plain about this. I mean, I want to choose my words. We never want to be, we never want to say thing about arguments that people have in a way that we make it sound like these people are, see, well, I'm even doing it now when I'm trying not to, that our brethren are just being totally crazy. I don't want to sound offensive. But many of our brothers and sisters will say, well, if Jesus returns in chapter 37 of Ezekiel, then everything in Ezekiel 38 has to be after his advent. And we all know that we have heard that position argued, right? We've heard it. But it's not consistent. In Ezekiel chapter 34, for instance, take a look there. Verse 23 and 24 of Ezekiel 34. The prophecy has this in it: "And I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David." Who's this? Any debate in your mind as to who's being spoken of here? It's Jesus, is it not? Is he not the great shepherd? "He shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd. And I, Yahweh, will be their God, and my servant David a prince among them. I, Yahweh, have spoken it, and I will make with them a covenant of peace, and will cause the evil beast," think Daniel 7, "to cease out of the land, and they shall dwell safely in the wilderness and sleep in the woods. And I will make them in the places round about my hill a blessing. And I will cause the shower to come down in his season. There shall be showers of blessings." Well, pretty clearly, the 34th chapter concludes with the return of Christ. So, if those brethren who want to argue that these chapters are meant to be chronological are going to be true to their argument, they must then believe that Christ returns in chapter 34, goes away in 35, comes back in 36, and then somehow goes away and it's not told us because then he comes back again in 37, and then he comes back again in 39. The truth of the matter, young people and brethren, is just like Daniel is laid out with several prophecies that end at the same event, so does Ezekiel. Chapter 34 ends with the kingdom. Chapter 36 ends with the kingdom. 37 ends with the kingdom. The prophecy of 38 and 39 ends with the kingdom. They are not meant to be taken chronological. I've repeated that phrase now probably 7 or 8 times on purpose. And when we realize that, we will be able to properly understand the prophecies. And that's critical. So, we have national revival and instruction mentioned in chapter 34, 36, 37, and 38. We have the nation humbled in 35, 37, 38, 39. You know, these events are laid out for us to help us see the clear picture. And unless you understand that chapter 34, 36, 37, and 38 and 39 are all different points of view of the same event, we will not be able to properly understand what we're reading. Okay? Maybe that'll lay the foundation for some of our future studies on that. One other item that I have mentioned before that has been objected to, Ezekiel 38:17. I think this is a very telling verse, very important verse. Within that chapter, Ezekiel writes, I've got it on the overhead and here I am trying to turn it up. I should probably just read it as I have it for the sake of time. Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, art thou he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servants, the prophets of Israel, which prophesied in those days many years that I would bring thee against them? This verse tells us that all the prophets of Yahweh have prophesied of Gog. Art thou he of whom I have spoken of in old time by my servants? That's all inclusive, the prophets. Therefore, what is said here in Ezekiel 38 has to have been dealt with by all the prophets. Isaiah has to have talked about it. Jeremiah alludes to the events. All the prophets. We can pick any of them out. Daniel has to be referred to here. Now, here's the objection that has come back since I relied on this verse at a gathering, well, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago. Well, Daniel hadn't written anything yet, so this verse doesn't apply to him. It applies to all the prophets but Daniel. Two responses to that. Do you really think that God would have every one of his prophets talk about Gog but say, not you, Daniel, you don't get to? Is that logical? No, it's not. Some of y'all really can't see this on the back wall. But is Daniel really a prophet that came after Ezekiel? And that's the second point I would make to you. That's not necessarily the case too. When Daniel saw Nebuchadnezzar's image, he was approximately 19 years old. And it is an event that clearly took place before Ezekiel 38. Because when Ezekiel says, if there were three men that would have been in the nation of Israel, they couldn't have made it righteous. Who were one of those three men? Daniel. All of the prophets in this verse are said to have spoken about Gog. He's that important. We've got to find him in Daniel then. And we do. We find him in the image. We find him in chapter 7. in the fourth beast, we find him in chapter 8 as that entity that stands up against the prince of princes. We find him in the prophecy of 11 and 12 in the king of the north. All of the prophets have talked about him, including Daniel. And I really don't think that those that would argue with me on this point, if they really thought about it, because quite frankly, one of those brethren who has written about this is a young man who I have good feelings for. We're friends. And I've said the same thing to him. I said, do you really think that Daniel was excluded of speaking of something that everybody else got to talk to? Is that really logical? And to be honest, he said, yeah, I guess you're right. You know, so this is just not that hard, brothers and sisters and young people. We've just got to make sure we're reading carefully. It's pretty straightforward. When Brother Ernie asked me to give a talk on Gog, the fourth beast and the false prophet, my first thought was, I ain't finishing that in 3 hours. But be that as it may, we're going to try now to talk about the fourth beast and the false prophet as best we can. And there's one thing that I really want to do at the end that might take me a little bit of time, and I'm going to ask you to bear with me. When we get then to this discussion of the false beast, the fourth beast and the false prophet, we have to start in chapter 7, and I'm going to spend the majority of the time there. And then I want to try to briefly connect it with what takes place in the apocalypse. One of the things that has been questioned over the years is whether the false prophet has any connection with the fourth beast. And I really think this has to be one conversation. There is an elder brother that I love dearly who has always told me, Mac, the false prophet's Muhammad. It's Islam. But as we go through this, young people, brothers and sisters, I want to make the case clearly from the Bible that the false prophet of the scriptures is connected with the fourth beast, with the iron power, with Nebuchadnezzar's image, and it's an undeniable fact that we cannot separate the false prophet from that entity. So, let's talk about this. Back to this chart that I put together. All right, the false prophet is going to come from Daniel 7's fourth beast. And we're going to try to go through this. When we get to this creature that is very difficult to describe artistically because there's not a lot of detail given here, a lot of times we might take Revelation 13 and the beast of the sea and use those characteristics, and maybe rightfully so, but I do think it's interesting that Daniel wasn't given that detailed description that John was, and there may be a good reason for that. Maybe a transition of time periods represented that I know I'm not going to have enough time to get to, but the false prophet comes from the fourth beast. In Daniel chapter 7, we had four beasts that arise out of the sea. And on this chart, we have here presented that the first, the lion, is connected then with the head of gold, the Assyrio-Babylonian image. In Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 17, we have mentioned there very clear for us these words. Israel is a scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. First, the king of Assyria hath devoured him. And last, this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, hath broken his bones. So we start very clearly with the first beast related to Babylon. And we're going to see a historical progression that is similar to Daniel chapter 2. But by the time we get to the fourth beast, we're going to strongly suggest to you that just as the image did not exist until all the parts stood, that fourth beast is going to be a compilation of all that came before it as well. All right, let's look at this. This is a well-known depiction of a Babylonian lion representing the types of things that were in the architecture of the day in Babylon. The same depiction is found in the British Museum of a Babylonian lion. And it escapes me at this point, and I forgot to write this note. I've got it on another presentation of where this came from. But this is from the British Museum, and it's an artifact, an actual wall that came forth from Babylonian architecture. And I forget the exact wall that it is associated with. Somebody else might remember that, but that's okay. So we know then that this first beast is associated with Babylon. So what I want you to see is that progression from the head of gold to the lion. Pretty straightforward, easy to determine. The bear. Daniel has this to say in chapter 7. And another beast, a second. I want y'all to note that language. A second beast. All right? A second, like to a bear, raised itself up on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. We see that this is a representation of the Medo-Persian Empire, this bear. It's also very interesting that Ross is symbolized by a bear as well. The characteristic of that beast is one that is passed down upon it. There is a reason why the bear had three ribs within its mouth. These three ribs related to three of the sections of the Babylonian kingdom, namely those of Babylonia, Egypt, and Lydia. And remember that Daniel was made a president, as it were, to help rule over these dominions. When Cyrus came to the throne, he faced opposition in three areas, and he conquered all of these regions, and he then reigned much supreme. He arose and he devoured much flesh. The leopard is next mentioned in Daniel chapter 7, verse 6. After this I beheld, and lo, another, a third if you will, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. This four-headed beast is clearly the Grecian Empire. Now think about this and how the different views of the vision are laid out. Look at Daniel chapter 8 for a moment. And in Daniel chapter 8, as we consider the Grecian dominion here, we see why there are four wings and four heads upon the leopard. Daniel chapter 8, in the explanation of the vision, in verse 20. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, Alexander the Great. Now, that horn, that is, being broken, four stood up for it. Four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So we see in both chapter 7 and chapter 8, there's agreement that the Grecian power divided itself into four different powers. The two that we spend most time talking about within Scripture is that of the Seleucid kingdom in the Ptolemaic. The Seleucid kingdom being the king of the north, and the Ptolemaic, for a time, being considered the king of the south. Now, you know, brothers and sisters and young people, as you try to put all of these things together, there's a reason then, as you consider this progression in Daniel chapter 7 and in chapter 8, why the Greek power is divided up into four kingdoms, and for a time one of them is called the king of the south. But there's a reason then, and just file this away in the back of your mind, and I don't know exactly what Brother Tom's going to talk about Monday. I'm probably putting a lot more on him than he's going to be able to cover. But there's going to then be a reason why in Daniel chapter 11, while Egypt is never called the king of the south in that chapter, the king of the north comes against Egypt, right? There, not the king of the south, because it's going to be depicting a time that Egypt is no longer the king of the south. Someone else has taken that role. So it's important just to pay attention to the language there. It all makes great sense for us. In Daniel chapter 11, once again, when we start off the prophecy and when we think about it, we see the connection between Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel 8 clearly identified for us, because Daniel 11 is going to pick up at a point where we can readily identify these powers, and it's going to tell us that all of this is related, right? And Daniel 7 is related to Daniel 11. Verse 1, "Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all." That was Xerxes. "And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. A mighty king, Alexander, shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven." The four heads, the four wings of the leopard, all right? "And not to his posterity," or not of his seed, "not according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those." So we see a relationship then when we get to Daniel 7, we've got this leopard. We see a relationship to Daniel 8 and Daniel 11 pretty clearly in what takes place with the fourfold division. So we know that those chapters are going to follow along the same line, different points of view, some different details of the same vision, and we know it relates certainly back to Daniel 2 and Nebuchadnezzar's image. So, the leopard. Then we come up to this fourth beast. And this beast is going to be very prolific throughout the history of the scriptures, of Daniel and of the apocalypse. What does it look like? Well, I think there's a reason why we're not given a detailed description. All right, in Daniel chapter 7, what we are told, Daniel 7 and 7, "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. It was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. It was different than all the beasts that were before it, but it had 10 horns. Verse 19 of the chapter, still speaking of the fourth beast, "Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all those others, exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue of his feet." And then I want to pay attention to verses 23 and 24, particularly at this moment. "Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the ten horns, and we could insert a parenthetical insert in our own minds here. I'm not going to insert, tell you to insert it into the scripture, but in your minds, think about this. If Daniel says the fourth beast is the fourth kingdom, then we know that the ten horns are described how in Daniel chapter 2? Ten toes. There's a relationship here. If the fourth beast is the fourth kingdom, no fifth kingdom, there isn't one. Daniel 2 didn't give us a fifth kingdom. Daniel 7 doesn't give us a fifth beast, just four. The ten kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws. And they shall be given into his hand until a time, times, and a dividing of time. So we see that this fourth beast, it's dreadful, terrible. It has iron teeth. It has nails of brass. It has ten horns, which we're told are ten kings, which we can conclude from chapter 2 are described as ten toes there. Easy to follow information. Now, file this one thought away as you're going to study this in a lot more detail in the future, and I'm going to not be able to talk about it with the length that I want to here. The reason why the body of the beast is not so detailed described here in chapter 7 is because the fourth beast is going to go through quite a long period of time. We see in what I read in verse 25, 1260 years. And throughout that time, it had a lot of different personalities to it, if you will. Well, personalities isn't the phrase I want to use. It has a characteristic, obviously, here, personality, dreadful and terrible. But it had different phases. That's what I want to say. And the apocalypse is going to show us those phases in the dragon, which had ten horns, in the beast of the sea, which had ten horns and seven heads in both of those, in the two-horned beast, and then the scarlet-colored beast. And I think that's why Daniel doesn't give us a description, because we're not meant to chapter 7 to try to identify this as any one particular beast, because later on in the apocalypse, there's going to be the dragon, the beast of the sea, the beast of the earth, right, that two-horned beast, the image of the beast, and the scarlet-colored beast, which are all different phases of this fourth beast. So I think it's proper that there's no exact description here, because we're going to see different phases in the apocalypse of it. Okay, and here I just kind of previewed all this, didn't I? If I would have looked over here, I would have seen the next slide coming. So, just as we were able to chart out Daniel's prophecies, Ezekiel's prophecies, I think we can chart out also the fourth beast in its career and see the similarities that are here between all of these that are very, very interesting. Daniel's fourth beast, ten horns. The great red dragon of chapter 12, pagan Rome, ten horns, seven heads. The beast of the sea, we have seven heads, ten horns. The only difference that appeared from here to here is that we have only one horn mentioned in Daniel 7, but we have seven horns mentioned here. And then we get to the scarlet-colored beast of chapter 17, and we have seven heads, ten horns. The constant throughout is ten horns, from Daniel's fourth beast to the great red dragon, the beast of the sea, and the scarlet-colored beast. One continual thought that continues through all of these prophecies is war with the saints. Daniel 7:21, the same horn made war with the saints. 12:17 of the apocalypse, the dragon went to make war with the remnant of their seed. We might have a lot more to say about that phrase, remnant of the seed, if we had time, though. Chapter 13, it was given unto him to make war with the saints. Then we get to chapter 17, these shall make war with the Lamb. So there's a lot of constants here that are going to go through these different phases of the fourth beast. And they're all destined to make war with the Lamb. And then we come to this interesting time period factor, which I want to try to conclude on in a short time. Daniel 7 says this fourth beast will have a career of a time, times, and a dividing of time. And I want y'all to really think about that, and some of you might see where I'm going to go with that. Daniel 7 has a specific time period of a career for the fourth beast. Time, times, and a dividing of time. One time, 1 year of 360 days in a Hebrew calendar, 360 years, two times, 720 years, and then we've got the dividing of time, you know, the half of the 360. All of that together is 1,260 years. When we look at the great red dragon, we have a time period associated with it in the 14th and 6th verses of a time, times, and a half, and 1,260 days in verse 6. Then when we get to chapter 13, it's 42 months, which 42 months of 30 days, and I know I'm going really fast, I apologize for that, is 1,260 days. And then we're going to come to this point with the scarlet colored beast where we're going to come to a point where there is no time left. So the progression that we see is Daniel's fourth beast. These are all aspects of it, and there will come to a time where there is no time left. And no time left is going to come at the hands of Christ and the saints. So just like we did when we charted out the others, I'm going to make the case here that we need to find a relationship here with Daniel 7:25, and let's move all the way down here with the no time left that is going to be very, very important for us. This is out of Brother Bartholomew's book, and I lightened up the light and the contrast, but this is one slide I thought was going to suffer from the change of the projector, but that's okay. It's probably better that we did this. I changed Brother Bartholomew's chart here, and of course I did that because I thought I was right and he was wrong on a couple of things, and that's easy to say, isn't it? As we go through these beasts, and the beast of the sea, and the beast of the earth, and the image of the beast, Brother Bartholomew had a date here for the beast of the sea that I'm going to suggest must be looked at differently. All right? 554 A.D., and then the two witnesses and the earth and woman, I wrote 1073 A.D. It's 11:30, and I have not near the time that I wanted to do to go into this. But for everybody, young and old and young people, let's just go to Revelation chapter 12 for a moment, and let's just try to give you some things to think about these horns and these heads and the time periods they relate to. Because as I said, I want to try to identify players and time periods for you so that we can build upon that, not just in Monday, but in many future classes, Lord willing, because it's going to take a great deal of time to get there. Okay, Revelation 12, verse 3. There appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having seven heads and ten horns, and then seven crowns upon his heads. Here's the Cliff Notes version of this. If we have ten horns, and we're told in Daniel 7:24 that the ten horns represent ten kings, that becomes pretty easy for us to figure out what's represented here. We know that the horns represent kings throughout. Chapter 17 of Revelation is going to make that abundantly clear for us again, where we see in chapter 17, in verse 12, the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings. The seven heads here, it must be noted that in chapter 12 are crowned. And in chapter 13, where do those crowns go? Are they on the heads anymore? No, they're on the horns. Did I say 17 right there or 13? I want to know if I said it right or wrong, because sometimes I even doubt, even when I didn't make a misspeak, sometimes I'm worried I did. In chapter 13, the crowns go from being upon the heads to upon the horns. And that's a very significant event. So, the seven heads, what do they represent? Well, let's go back to chapter 17 and look at verse 10 and we'll get the answer. Chapter 17, verse 10. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, and the other is not yet come. So when John wrote, throughout this beast systems phase of the iron power, there had been five different forms of government that had come and gone. He was living under one that was called the sixth, and then there was a seventh to come. The difference then between chapter 12 and chapter 13 then that is critical to understand is this. The horns go to the crowns, which means the seventh head had come to its end. That seventh head was the Gothic head, which did not cease to rule over all of the tenfold division of the Roman Empire until 554 AD. It's interesting, when the barbarian nations came in 476, the dynamic of this is Western Rome was divided into 10 parts, and all the barbarians ruled over those 10. But yet, as Rome had continued to lay down the law prior to 476, after that, all of the barbarians still looked up to Rome for direction, and they had to rule the people they were ruling over. In fact, and you look at the coins of all the barbarians, like the Franks, on one side would be the Franks and on the other side would be Rome. So the beast of the sea will not begin its career until the Gothic head phase ended in 554. And then we picked up the beast of the sea phase and the real influence of papal Rome. Now, why did I go through all that? It might seem to be a little bit disconnected from my subject. And it may not have sunk in as well as I wanted it to with you. For you young people, there's two books that I think, three books that can help you. First, Eureka, obviously. The second is Brother Bartholomew's book. Even though I disagreed with his dates, they're still excellent, very good. And then there's another book written by an author. It's called Hear What the Spirit Saith to the Ecclesias. And I don't even know if that book's in print anymore. But it's one of the best books on the apocalypse that I've read in short answer form. But the reason why I wanted to go through that is because when we get to this beast of the sea and the Gothic head is now gone, we're going to see the rise of the papal power. And that's going to be very important for where we're going to go for the rest of our discussions here. Let's go back to chapter 7 of Daniel. And now let's try to talk about this fourth beast in its little horn phase, its beast of the sea phase being connected with it, and the two horned beasts and the image of the beast, the scarlet colored beast, all kind of wrapped together there. Okay, Daniel chapter 7. We get to some very, very important things here. Let me go back to verse 7 and just start there. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, strong exceeding, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the other beasts that was before it. And it had 10 horns. And then Daniel considers, and this is what he sees happen. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among these 10 horns another a little horn, an 11th, if you will, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. This is the false prophet. In the debate that we sometimes have, brethren, about who the identity of the false prophet is, then, we have to see a connection between this false prophet and the fourth beast. We have to see it outgrowing from it. That is something that you cannot find if the false prophet is Muhammad. There's no connection historically to growing out of the Roman Empire. It was not a product of Rome, pagan or religious, in any form or fashion. Its growth was something totally separate from that. And in fact, in the apocalypse, we're going to find those powers had a very specific purpose. And with 20 minutes, or actually really 5 minutes, I can't go into that any more than that. I need to stick with my subject. But let's make sure we see the relationship between the false prophet and the little horn. Okay. We've got Daniel chapter 7 and verse 20. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth and spake very great things or great blasphemies, whose look was more stout than his fellows. In chapter 8, we see a description of this power as well. In verse 25, through his policy shall he cause craft to prosper, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many, and he shall stand up against the prince of princes. In chapter 13 of the Apocalypse, he is described this way in the beast of the sea phase. He is described as one whose mouth was in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell therein. And in chapter 16, he is described this way. I saw 3 unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. And in identifying these players, brethren, let's just say this in short. When we think about this unclean spirit, this spirit of democracy, does it exist in Muslim civilization? I mean, some people want to say it does in this Arab Spring, but the Arab Spring is not winning the day, folks. You know, do you see it in winning the day at all in Persia, in those areas that are important? But this unclean spirit certainly is manifested in the papacy, and it is certainly manifested in the fourth beast and in the dragon power at this point in time. In chapter 19 of the Apocalypse, I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army, and the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, which he deceived them that they had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast live into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. Now, as I finish this chart, I need to make sure I really have set the stage well, because in trying to go a little bit quicker through some of these things, I'm afraid I skipped so much of what I intended to say that I'm not making any sense. So let me just stop for a second and tell you that the import that I want you to see here about the false prophet is clearly we have this little horn arise in chapter 7 of Daniel that speaks great blasphemies. By the time we get to chapter 19, and there's only 2 phrases that we see this false prophet, where we see it in the Apocalypse, where the phrase false prophet is used, chapter 16 and chapter 19. Is there any doubt from chapter 19 that there has to be a relationship with the false prophet to the beast and its image? Is there any doubt that there has to be a commonality of goals that do not exist between anything that rose out of Muhammadan in the beast system? But chapter 19 is clear. The false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. So the false prophet is clearly an outgrowth then of what was Rome. And that is the important point here, brethren. We can't take this phrase, this scriptural phrase, false prophet, and determine that, well, this was Muhammad and this is everything Muslim. Because the only way we can do that is totally pretend the phrase doesn't exist in the Bible, because in the Bible it's very clear that it's associated with the fourth beast. And we can't divorce those facts one from another. From Daniel to the apocalypse, the false prophet is related to the fourth kingdom. Now, as I've tried to make the case in the chart that I put together on Daniel, I want to try to summarize things and conclude in a particular way, because I did not want to go too much further past 10:45, which the clock says we're, or 11:45, which the clock says we're there. Let's pay attention to some things in chapter 7 that I think are very, very critical here. Number one, I made the point in chapter 8 that this little horn, this false prophet that is part of the fourth beast, it is seen in the chapter as having its roots in the plucking up of three other horns. Let's look forward, and I read some of these verses, but now I want to read them in detail. Let's go to verse 17. These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever, and ever. Now let's stop there and let's comment upon that. What does that teach us? That teaches us the point we've been making since the start. The fourth beast is the fourth kingdom. These four beasts arise out of the earth. These four kings, as it is here, exist until what point in time? Till the saints of the Most High take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. So the fourth beast and the false prophet's career will continue until Christ and the saints defeat it. Keep that in your heads. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which diverged from all the others and exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and nails are of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell. That's a signal event. I'm going to say something about that in a moment. Even of that horn which had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. The fourth beast and the false prophet then is destined to prevail against the saints. And then the next verse tells us until when they will prevail against the saints of the Most High. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. And the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. All right. Let's talk about this 1260 period then for a moment, because I think this is very, very critical. There are some very notable epics that we can look at. And if you remember, if you were here this summer, Brother Al Bryan, you know, talked about some of these epics. And a lot of writers will relate these epics to the verses that we just read and talk about them in relation to there, to the time, times, and a dividing of time that we read of in verse 25. We didn't read through everything here because verse 23 kind of picks up, reviews what we already read, but includes the time period of the career of the fourth beast and false prophet. Well, these are all very interesting dates, and I personally believe they were something that Yahweh intended to give strength and comfort to the believers. But I am going to suggest to you that Yahweh never intended us to understand that these two suggested dates are the time period that is referred to in Daniel 7. Exposition of Daniel, pages 17 and 18. I think this is a really great quote. And go read through it and digest it and think about it. But at what time does Jesus appear? This is found by attending to what is said concerning the little horn power and the holy ones. It, the fourth beast, this little horn, this false prophet, it is to prevail against them until the Ancient of Days come, which until is indicated in the words, the holy one shall be given unto his power until a time and times and the dividing of time. Hence, the Ancient of Days will come at the end of this period, which has not yet expired. For if it had, the Ancient of Days would now be in Teman, or in the south of the Holy One, Holy Land. The Holy Ones would be preparing to execute judgment, and the season and time would be at hand. I think Brother Thomas has hit the nail on the head right here. The 1260-year period ends at the return of Christ. Now the question then begins, well, all right, when's that going to be, Mac? And this is where I'm going to get into a little bit of discussion on what we can expect. You know, there was a great deal of time when I was young that, you know, we would have brethren stand up and they would put charts up and give us dates and get all excited, right? And the dates turned out not to be right. And as a result of that, I am afraid that we have turned into a community that, well, let's not speculate on these dates anymore because I don't want to have egg on my face. And I think that's not the way it should be. And let's go back to chapter 12. I want to read two verses. And this is where I know I'm 4 minutes past time. I want y'all to indulge me for a little bit because I want to talk about this. I think it's important to consider. Daniel chapter 12. We find written here, verse 2, many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. All right. The only point that I'm making there is, once again, the resurrected saints that are granted immortality are called wise here. And then this verse is kind of sobering. I read it earlier, but I want to just present it to you. I want you to think about it. Verse 10, many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And then in verse 11 and in verse 12, we're given some more dates that sometimes somebody goes, well, when are those dates in? And I don't know. Sometimes I've given that response too much, and I guess these verses have bothered me. The wise will understand. Yahweh meant for us to figure this out. He meant for us to get it, and I'm afraid we've stopped trying to figure it out. And it's kind of scary sometimes to think that if the wise are going to understand and then the only other class mentioned are the wicked, and maybe I've spent too many years telling people that have asked me, when do you think these dates end? And I go, I don't know. That verse is pretty sobering, isn't it? Well, I want you to think about a couple of things, because in chapter 12, I want to read one verse here, maybe two. Verse 5, let me read this section here as well. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank of the river and the other on that side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever that it shall be for a time, times, and a half. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. Well, the interesting thing that I want you to pay attention to there in verse 7 is whatever the time period is, the time times and a half here of Daniel 12:7, it ends with the same event of Daniel 7, doesn't it? They both end with the same event. They end with a time where the power of the holy people can no longer be scattered. Now, where are we going to apply the beginning of this date then? And that's been the real question. And in relation to chapter 12, the second question, which some of you are going to ask me, is, well, Mac, isn't that 1260-year period a double time period because the man had up two hands? And for many years, we all loved Brother Laird's chart. It made a lot of sense to us, didn't it? I mean, it looked pretty good. But for the life of me, I cannot figure where you would take a 25-20-year period right now and start it that would end at these terminal epochs of Daniel 7 and Daniel 12, of which the little horn of the false prophet can no longer prevail against the saints. So I'm going to suggest to you that the thinking that the man in the middle of the river with two hands represented a double time period was not correct. Is there a 25-20 time period? Yeah, Daniel mentions one, a very signal one at that. But I would suggest to you that we were only supposed to be looking at 1260 years in Daniel 12. When does it start? Very signal event in Daniel chapter 7 that I think we've overlooked. Critical clue. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up one among them, another little horn, who before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes and a mouth speaking great things. The little horn that is to prevail 1260 years begins its career when it has three other horns plucked up for them. When did that happen? That's the real question. And I think we can figure this out. I think we can identify it. Pepin was able to overcome the horns of Ravenna, of Lombard, and the state of Rome, and turn them over to the little horn of the goat. Now, Langer's Encyclopedia of World History dates this event at 756 AD. All right? Gibbon says the three horns were plucked up by the roots in 758 AD. Well, I'm going to compromise in the middle because we all know how much we like sevens, right? Christadelphians love sevens. Years ending in seven make a lot of sense to us. So then, somewhere between 756 and 758, let's just call it 757, the three horns were plucked up and the little horn began its career. I think that's a pretty logical point of what Daniel 7's telling us here. Now, we know that the career of the little horn is 1260 days. So our suggestion for you then is this, that the career of the little horn of the false prophet must needs come to an end by the year 2017. We all like those seven dates. All right, maybe Langer's Encyclopedia is good on the 756 date, so maybe it's 2016. Maybe Gibbon's right, maybe 2018. But I'm going to suggest to you the dates that we really should have been looking for all along. All right, and I'm not being dogmatic on this, but on the other hand, isn't it sobering to know that the wise are supposed to figure it out? I mean, that's what the Bible says. The wise are going to understand. So we need to find a way to figure this out. Now, if I'm not right, somebody needs to help me get it because I don't want to be of the wicked class. I want to be part of the wise class. So I think that it makes perfect sense for us. The Ancient of Days will continue. The Ancient of Days will destroy this papacy, this little horn power. And what does that tell us about chapter 17? Well, this is where I think this is somewhat interesting. Now, I know I'm going to get some conversation from some people. Well, Brother Mac, all your dates here, you've missed something. Where's your 40-year period? You didn't give us one. Because I'm about ready to go through some dates. So there's no 40-year period in your thinking. And maybe we've kind of done too much. Does any of Daniel's dates, the book unsealed, which the apocalypse is the book, I mean the book sealed and the apocalypse is the book unsealed, is there any 40-year periods in Daniel? Nope. He doesn't have them. Maybe we've been trying to squeeze a concept in here because we liked it and because there certainly are probation periods represented throughout the Scripture that must come to pass, and maybe we've tried to figure this in here. And some of you may come up to me and say, well, Brother Mack, the 40-year period is clearly represented in the apocalypse, in the 1,600 furlongs of the horses' bridles. But guess what? That is a depiction of not the harvest of the earth, but the vintage of the earth. Now, I probably lost some of you young people there. We got the harvest of the earth, which relates to, you know, the overthrowing of the nations of Gog, and then we have the period of the vintage of the earth, which will be a period that encompasses war with the papacy. And so a lot of times we've said that 1,600 furlongs at the end of that chapter where it says, in the vintage of the earth that the horse will come to the horse's bridle, 1,600 furlongs, we said there's our 40-year period that starts at the resurrection and the judgment and goes on, but it's 1,600 furlongs that relates to the vintage of the earth. So in my mind, I've kind of abandoned the 40-year model. And I've done so because Daniel doesn't give us one. So let's go through this. And this is something y'all can help me with if I'm wrong. But let's talk about Daniel's time periods. The first one, the 1,260-year period, I would suggest then goes from 757 to 2017. Three barbarian kings were plucked up by the roots within those 3 years. And the Bible tells us that that's when the little horn that speaks great blasphemies arise. When those three kings were plucked up, that has to be our beginning date in my mind. And I think we can expect the career then to last till 2017. And I would suggest to you that that date corresponds to the date given us in Daniel 12 and verse 7. Following upon that, we have a 1,290-year period. And I would suggest to you that that would end in 2047 and relates to the period of the 1 hour with the beast. In 2017, somewhere thereabouts, no longer will the little horn have the ability to persecute the saints because they will have been resurrected in Teman and made immortal. But Daniel's next date he gives us is 1290. Could that possibly then be the end of the 1 hour with the beast, in which not only can the little horn not persecute the saints, but its rule over the nations comes to an end? And then we get to a 1335 period. Might that date end in 2092? And this is, I realize I am somewhat speculating here. I'm going to suggest to you that because there are adequate scriptural examples, such as Isaiah's testimony, that the nations will help build Ezekiel's temple, it's hard for those nations to start helping that construction until the 30-year period is over. I would anticipate that by 2092, Ezekiel's temple will stand in the Holy Land.